Welcome to After the Buzzer from the Man Cave, Mike Gross and Gordy Jones. How you doing, Gordy?
I'm outstanding. And yourself?
You look fabulous with the Packers gear on. I'm good. Everything's good. Except I'm a little hoarse, so you guys might have to carry me even more so than usual. And apropos to that, we have a guest here who is going to be familiar to a lot of the Nittany Nation that we talk about a lot. He is a former Penn State quarterback, a former four-year starter at quarterback for Penn State, and a guy who had a unique career. We're going to talk about that and maybe relate it to some of the things that are going on in Happy Valley now. Zach Mills, welcome to After the Buzzer.
Thank you so much for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
Let's talk about how close are you to Penn State football now?
I follow it for sure. I make sure I set aside time on Saturdays to watch all the games. I'm not inundated day to day with all the recruiting, especially with the portal and how that's taken on a thing of its own. But I'm definitely looped in on Saturdays in the fall.
Something that I've thought of a lot, not a lot, but more several times, is that this RPO stuff that is so popular now would have been a really good fit for you. Has that occurred to you?
Maybe once or twice.
Yeah. I think that would fun. Really. Yeah. That's it. Now, when you watch that, what do you think? How would you think your strengths would have fit with that?
Yeah, I think that's where it kind of hits home, is that, you know, my strengths of decision making, getting the ball out of my hands quickly and reading the defense, would have really thrived in this era of the RPO and that type of offense.
You were like a point guard, man, a little bit. I felt
yeah,
like.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way I sort of looked at it, especially, you know, in the first couple of years in 2001, 2002, we had so much talent at skill positions that, you know, really my job was to get them the ball in space and let them make plays. Mm-hmm.
I mean, you were there, the whole quarterback carousel thing and living life in the fishbowl. I'm guessing you can really relate to what's going on there now with Sean Clifford and Drew Aller and, you know, should this guy play, should that guy play? I mean, you were kind of involved with that. So what's that like and how do you negotiate that as, you know, a guy in your 20s?
Yeah, it's tough. It's definitely ebbs and flows. Like, you know, I was on both sides of it, to be honest. Yeah, I was the freshman newcomer that everyone wanted to see play, and you know, Matt Seneca was the starter at the time, and then was fortunate enough to get in there and play a little bit and become kind of a full-time starter the back half of that year. At that point, when I was so young and new to it, it was all kind of over my head in a sense. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm just focused on trying to get out there and be prepared as I can and not make a fool of myself when I get out on the field. As you get older and you hear it more and more, you kind of become more aware of your surroundings, so to say. Mm-hmm. And you have to be very, very strong mentally to fight that off. And yeah, you cannot read stuff and hear stuff, but you know, it just a matter of time before it eventually starts to creep in. And you know, I feel for Sean. I think Coach Franklin's doing a good job every week with, you know, his press conferences and whatnot, with kind of laying out the land and how they see things. And so, you know, it's a tough road to navigate. But the key for me in my experience was that the quarterback room that I was in, I was so fortunate. It was so positive and everyone got along. I mean, we were pushing each other the entire way. Like Mike and Michael Robinson and I were fiercely competitive and we both wanted to play that position. But at the end of the day, we were very, very supportive of each other as well. So it wasn't like a personal thing. Same goes for me earlier in my career with Matt Seneca. Such a graceful guy with the way he handled that. He could have taken it out on me or made life more difficult for me. But again, so supportive, was there for me. I had his back, he had mine. And just very lucky with the people I had in that room during my career.
That's always fascinating to me, the whole thing about team chemistry, because everybody wants to play. Everybody was great in high school. And you have that dynamic, and then you, of course, you have the larger dynamic. Everybody wants to go out and win every week too. And if one overwhelms, or if the individual thing overwhelms the other thing, that can be really an issue. But obviously, it wasn't for you. But I you know, given certain personalities and certain positions, that can be an issue. I'm sure you've seen that through the years.
Yeah, I can't say that I haven't seen it over the years. Definitely has popped up here and there. Just lucky that it didn't occur in the room I was in, for sure. And I would imagine it's even more prevalent today when, you know, you can transfer and not sit out, or you can, jump in the portal and go to another school. We didn't have that, luxury, if you call it a luxury, to do that back then. So we would have to go somewhere, get permission, sit out a year, and it just wasn't a feasible move, given you'd only you have 5 years to play four, essentially.
I was talking to last week. I was talking to this guy who is Drew Aller's like personal quarterback coach, and he was talking about how a couple years ago, before Aller was even there, he got to sit in on one of their quarterback room meetings and film sessions, and he was so impressed with how sharp Clifford was, how much knowledge he had, how much understanding of protection he had, and all of that. And I guess I'm wondering, I'm thinking maybe if I'm a football coach, I would tend to favor a guy who does that, who can do that. That would be a natural thing in his favor. Talk about your experience being in that room over the years, and how much that means in terms of, you know, maybe separating yourself from the other quarterbacks in the room.
Twofold. The first thing that pops out on that is that the experience and the being able to look at film and pull out little nuances on a cornerback or a defense or know situationally what a team's going to do. To me, that was what kept me ahead, ahead of the game, is just being cerebral and knowing where to go with the ball, and knowing that on third and seven, okay, on third and seven to 10, 60% of the time, if they blitz, this is the blitz. This is their number one coverage. This is their number one front. And if it's not, if that doesn't occur, these are number two options. And just kind of seeing that happen, knowing in your head what possibly can happen, and then actually see it kind of come together on the field is so much of such an advantage. And then we game plan towards that. So we're not, you know, coaches aren't just pulling out a call sheet with 100 calls on it and picking one on those downs. They're calling plays based on what they think is going to happen in those scenarios too. So it's, for me, it's a very intriguing, you know, back and forth cat and mouse kind of game, especially in those third down situations. But to get back to your question, you know, the older you get, the kind of more you see things, and the more experience you have, and I think that can translate down. And I think that was super helpful for me too when I first got to Penn State. Is, again, I was lucky. I redshirted in my first year and got to watch Rashard Casey and was soaking in everything he was saying and doing in the room. And then with Matt Seneca, same thing, as they experienced different things throughout their career. So I was very much trying to soak in as much as I can, so that when I had my opportunity, I was prepared as I could be to go out there and play.
So you were a 4-year starter, but you had the whole redshirt year, and you know, this whole thing that, I mean, I cover Penn State, so I'm so immersed in this Clifford versus Aller thing.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that was the ideal maybe scenario for a young guy to get the redshirt year? Because everybody thinks, hey, Aller's a 5-star, throw him out there. You know, and especially since he can play a few games now and not have it count. You know what I'm saying? So do you feel like this was the ideal, the way it played out for you would maybe sort of be the ideal?
And from my experience, it definitely was. I mean, there was some small chatter about me possibly getting some playing time very early in my freshman year, and then they made the decision to redshirt me. And looking back, that was the best thing for me, just to get acclimated to the speed of the game, to the offense, two, three times a week. We were doing live periods with the first team defense. And that's something that you can't get when you're the backup or the third guy, you know, watching the first team guy take reps. Even just like getting hit by the first team defense, just getting used to that. I gained, and then the last thing is just getting used to the college life and being away and schoolwork and all that, so that workload, getting adjusted to that. So for me personally, looking back, that was huge for me. You know, nowadays it seems like that's not necessarily the norm, because everyone does want to play. And I get that too. And I think, you know, with as you just mentioned, you talked with Aller's quarterback coach or private coach, you know, there weren't necessarily a lot of those guys 20 years ago doing that. So, so I think, you know, maybe they're a little more prepared to play earlier than we were back then. So that there's credit to those folks as well.
Interesting. You came in the same year as a kid named Zach Wasserman, a quarterback from California. I'm just curious what that's like. Are you kind of like eyeballing each other like the first time? What's that like?
Yeah, maybe a little bit. You're probably not wrong there with just, you know, sizing each other up and stuff. But Zach was a great quarterback. He was a big kid. He was bigger than me, and he had a stronger arm than me.
Right.
But, you know, the way I looked at it and the way that, you know, my family looked at it was when we were looking at our different options was I'd rather compete against someone coming in my age that has the same knowledge base as far as the offense and whatnot as I do versus competing against someone a year or 2 years older than me that's been there already and kind of got their feet under them. Mm-hmm. So I didn't shy away from it, and I was looking forward to competing with someone just, you know, for that reason. And if I could beat Zach out, I knew that the following year after redshirted, I would have a real good chance to be the backup. And then from there, you're just a play away from getting in.
Right, and that's what happened. And Wasserman ended up leaving, as I recall. And he's now, I looked him up earlier today, he is now an assistant baseball coach at Xavier.
Really?
Yeah, how about that?
Wow, I would have never guessed that in a million years.
Yeah, it's likewise. So the first game you actually played in 2001 was only against Miami. You came in as the backup. And I looked that up, too. They had 17 first-round draft picks on that team. And their tailback depth chart was Clinton Portis, Willis McGahee, and Frank Gore. Frank Gore was the third string guy.
Yeah, that team was insane. And I was thinking about that the other day when we were talking about getting together on this show. And I just was like, you know, Ed Reed, Mike Rumpf,
right,
DJ Williams, Jonathan Vilma, on and on and on that defense. And I'm like, wow, what a great experience for that first game. You know, to get in there and get thrown to it. I mean, playing against the best, one of arguably the best teams in the history of college football.
Yeah, okay.
A funny story I remember from that game was Matt hurt his elbow, so that's how I got in the game.
Right.
But he didn't go down. He came running off, and he said, "I can't feel my arm.
I remember that.
Yeah, we had to burn a timeout because I had to run back over. You know, because I was signaling in stuff. I had to run back over and grab my helmet. And by the time I got on there and got on the field, we had to burn a timeout. So, I just remember being a little nervous at the first start. We ran like a little quick play action. You know, slipped the fullback out, and I threw it at his feet. I could hear like the stands going, "Oh no, what do we got here?" But settled in pretty well, got kind of my feet wet, and it was a great experience to go against those guys. It was awesome.
Yeah, that might have been the best team in the history of college football.
It's in the discussion,
yeah,
for sure.
I mean,
yeah.
It's gotta be that a great team.
I mean, Vince Wilfork was a backup.
Right. And so was Sean Taylor.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right. I forgot about him. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Ed Reed and Sean Taylor.
Oh my God! Crazy.
Let's talk, Zach, a little bit about being recruited by Joe Paterno, because, well, one element of it is that you're from Maryland, and if I remember, you were not a Penn State fan, and probably wasn't like entranced by the Paterno mythology or anything like that. So with that in mind, tell me about your interaction with Joe when you're a high school kid and you're figuring out what you want to do next.
It was it was very interesting. You're right. I was not a Penn State fan. I grew up a Maryland fan. My grandfather had season tickets, and my dad had season tickets, so I grew up going down there. And if I'm sure you're familiar with the history of that.
Yeah.
That game, and back then they had beaten Penn State once and tied them once. I was at the game they tied in Baltimore when I was a kid. So I wasn't a huge fan of Penn State football growing up, to say the least, given that. But obviously very aware of them. And then once I got to the point where I had an opportunity to go and play for them, you know, that whole fan side of it kind of went away. And quickly became in awe of Joe and just amazing. I remember on a recruiting trip, might have been a spring game, we went up there, and he gets everyone in we were in a tent, and he gets everyone up there, his attention, and he gets up and stands on the table. Here's a 70-some-year-old man getting up there screaming and yelling and the table. He just had so much, I remember having so much energy and then just kind of being in awe. I mean, he was a living legend, and to be able to be a part of that recruitment process, have him come to your home. And he came down and went to a basketball practice and then came to my home and had dinner. And it just so cool to talk about and look back on and experience that.
Yeah, he was, I enjoyed covering him. And there's so many things I think about, funny stuff and interesting stuff about it. He was totally unique, totally unique.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Who did the best Joe impression on your teams?
I think everyone had a pretty good one. I mean, because his philosophy was, if you can't handle what he's going to bring to you in practice, you can't play in front of 110,000 people. So he would always test you, especially when you're young. And
right.
So by year one or two, I think everyone had a pretty good Joe and could get their voice up like this. And what are you doing, man? Type thing. So
thank you. Pretty strong.
You know, I throw my hat in the ring on that, and you know, I'm sure most other guys would say the same.
Yeah. It's the funny thing about imitating Joe is some of the best impressions are not like really accurate, but they're like a caricature, so they're funny as hell. You know.
Yeah. So I had the luxury of playing with Spice Adams for three,
oh my
4 years.
God! Oh yeah, my God!
He had a fantastic Joe. Now that you bring it up, it's just because of that, you know, he would really get into character and, you know,
oh
exaggerate
God.
Things. And, you know, he is. It was just hilarious.
And what was the pimp character that he did? It was Goldie, right?
Goldie, yes. I met her message him a few years ago because he's developed, like, he's got, like, what, Kareem Biggins and those guys, like, the basketball character. I was like, you got to bring Goldie back. He's like, oh, I don't know if I can do that nowadays.
Because I asked him about Goldie on Media Day once, and he was he was kind of amazed that we knew about it.
Yeah, I think he said it's something to the fact that he had to retire. Goldie retired or something like that.
It's an era. The era is gone.
He was a hell of a player, though, and a really good player for a long time in the NFL, too.
Yes, and great story, too, with his mom raising him and his father, and just a great family, and happy to see him doing so well, not only in the NFL, but even afterwards now with in the media and that type of stuff. So it's very cool.
Zach, the impression, this may be unfair, it may be inaccurate, but the impression that people have of the latter part of your career is that you kind of got beat up and you lost some arm strength as a result of it. Is there anything to that? Is that fair? Because I know a lot, you must know, a lot of people think that that's kind of the way your career evolved. Is that fair enough or not?
I think there's some validity to that. And, you know, I'd push back a little bit as well. I don't know if you measured my arm strength with how far I could throw the ball or the velocity. I don't know that I lost a lot of it.
Okay.
I think if you look at, you know, the personnel around me,
yes.
there was some drop off there. And, you know, as we talked about earlier with, you know, kind of the point guard mentality is, you know, if you don't have those, the Bryant Johnsons and the Larry Johnsons and the John Gilmores and those guys around you, it makes life difficult for the point guard. So, you know, I would also kind of point to that as well. And, you know, had we pulled out a couple more wins each of those years, maybe things are talked about a little bit differently, but at the end of the day, we didn't. And we were, We were close. You know, I look at a lot of those games, and there weren't a ton of blowouts. There was, you know, I remember 2003, we played Ohio State. They were ranked, and it went down to the end. And then, you know, Purdue one year went down to the end. And, you know, a lot of those close type of games where you make a play or two there, and your record of 4-7 or whatever it ended up being could be 6-5 or 7-4. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at the end of the day, we didn't. We were very close to doing that my last year. And I think that the last couple wins kind of helped curtail and give the confidence to the incoming group for that 05 run they had.
Yeah, that was, they really turned it around that year. But the other thing about your career is that 02 season. When Penn State was really, right, 0-2? When
they, yeah, 9-4.
Yeah,
there,
yeah,
when
yeah. You were so close to being good and so close to being great. I guess just what do you remember about that year in terms of the specifics of the games in which you had a chance to get over the top and didn't quite do it?
Yeah, two overtime losses, yeah. And then one throw against Ohio State, and maybe we end up winning 7-6 and not losing 13-7. Mm. I mean, that's really what it comes down to, is I made a, against Ohio State, kind of made a bad throw on a third down, forced something. Chris Gamble, great player, made the interception. I still say that he didn't make a great play. I made a really bad throw mm-hmm. on that specific play. Right. And our defense was playing fabulous. So that was that Craig Krenzel offense. Ohio State was kind of, you know, methodical, and they weren't going to put up 40 points. So, mm-hmm. you know, maybe we could have gotten that one. And then the other two against Michigan, we went to overtime. We had to settle for a field goal. I forget the defender, but he made a great play on a back shoulder fade to BJ, Brian Johnson. Mm-hmm. And if we're able to get that in, maybe we go to the second overtime and pull it out, but we didn't. We had to settle for a field goal, and they went down and punch it in. And then Iowa was that crazy game when we were down the whole game, came back, and then again made a they scored, I think, first in overtime, and then we had to go to a fourth down and weren't able to convert, and that was that. So 0-2 is the season that could have been, you know, yeah. is the way I look at it, and yeah. it's like literally yeah, like a play each game would make that difference, but mm-hmm. oftentimes that's what it ends up coming down to, you know.
Yeah. I remember you, you spoke with our friend Dave Jones, and he had a story about that season back in July. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the Gamble interception, and the other one you mentioned was how Mike was open on a screen pass, and you came off him in against Iowa. It's like, and it's like Dave says something, you're like, well, it's not like you're still dwelling on it, right?
No, I mean, those are the ones you just remember so vividly. Yeah, we had a double screen call on that fourth down, and first read was like Mike was running a swing pass, and we took a guard or tackle out with him who slipped out there, and mm-hmm. I just came off it maybe a half second too soon. And mm-hmm. if you watch it on tape, it does formulate, and it was there. And the second read was Larry on a more traditional pop screen on the left side, and you know, they had that one kind of sniffed out and had nowhere to go with the ball by that point. So but yeah, those are definitely the ones you remember. You remember the wins too, but the losses are the ones that kind of stick with you. Mm-hmm. Over the years,
of course, that was the year that LJ ran for 2,087. And you mentioned to Dave how Larry ran angry. Now, there was a guy that had spent, you know, most of his career kind of waiting his turn, and was really, much to his credit, he really made the most of it. I mean, you must have seen a lot of potential in him even before that season. Can you just describe his career arc?
Yeah, I think he was kind of flowed that old school traditional Joe Paterno where, you know, we've got a lot of talent at this position, and you're going to have to earn your stripes and wait your turn. And you could definitely see flashes of it. Mm-hmm. But we had so much talent there that other guys were getting opportunities. And I think they wanted to kind of, you know, the Eric McCous and Omar Easy's of the world had waited their turn. So Joe was going to give them every opportunity to get in there. And I think with Larry, the way he played and the way he ran, I think you know, sometimes earlier in his career, he maybe was just a touch impatient. Mm-hmm. And I think that when hitting holes or reading a defense and where to cut and that type of thing. And I think, you know, maybe that combined with some of the other talent at that position at that time kind of kept him from getting, you know, the bulk of the carries earlier in his mm-hmm. career.
We loved him because he was one of the few guys who would come in after the game and bitch about stuff.
Yeah. That didn't help him either. I remember my redshirt year. I think my redshirt year, maybe it was the next year, he popped off. It was my redshirt year. I think after a loss to Toledo, maybe?
Yeah, it was Toledo. It was Toledo. He ripped the offense.
Yeah, and so that was my first experience, because I was redshirting, of like, someone said something they shouldn't. And that, you know, that got him in the doghouse. And, and that took him a while to get out of it. So
near the end of your career, Zach, you went through some of this stuff that Sean Clifford is going through now, where the fan base is on you, and in some cases the students, even your fellow students, are on you, and in your case it was pretty clear that the weapons around you were, I mean, I thought that was pretty clear, but you know, it's easy to be the captain and the mentally tough guy when it's going well, but how hard was it to be that guy when it wasn't going well?
Towards the end, it was hard. I'm not going to lie. It wears on you. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I went through two of the most losing seasons in the history of Penn State football. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong, but back to back, we won, I think, 3 games, and then unfortunately only 4. Mm-hmm. You know, you're doing everything you can. I mean, towards the end of my last year, our backup quarterback became our leading receiver. Just to kind of tell you how the things were. But back to your question, it's really tough. It wears on you mentally, and it took me, you know, a couple years to get out and away from the game before I could get some better perspective on it. But it was frustrating, and but it comes with the territory. I remember my freshman year, Joe said, you know, criticism and praise are both like poison. If you drink too much of them, it's going to be the end of you. So, you know, I tried to fight that off in 2001 and 2002, and then I was doing the opposite and fighting the criticism off the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. But it's tough. I mean, people, and I can't imagine nowadays with Twitter and everything else. I think for me, Facebook had just gotten started and wasn't really much of anything, and there was no Twitter. So, mm-hmm. I mean, nowadays these guys have all that right at the fingertips of their phone, and mm-hmm. you know, if they can not read it, great. But you know, when you're in the stadium with all those people and hear the boos, you definitely hear that for mm-hmm. sure.
So what got you, you said it took you a year or two to get beyond that. How did you do that? Is it just a matter of just the passage of time, or is there something more to it than that?
Yeah, I think it's just the passage of time and getting older and having some perspective. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm at peace with it, and I tell people still today that if I had to, you know, could go back in, jump back in and pick where I was going to go to school, I'd go to Penn State, and mm-hmm. I'd want to win a few more games. But if that's the way it played out the same way, then I would do it again, because mm-hmm. it just made me a tough person and a tougher person, and also, you know, taught me about life at a really young age, because you're going to go through ups and downs personally, professionally, mm-hmm. as you get older. And it just prepares you for that.
Interesting.
I you got a little bit of a taste of the NFL with I think with Washington, right?
Yeah, very, very briefly, yeah.
and
a cup of coffee.
Yeah, for a while, were you playing weren't you playing tournament poker for a while?
I jumped into that a cup of coffee there, and then I realized I wasn't going to make a living doing that.
So anyway, where I'm clumsily going here, Zach, is the transition from having that competition being a daily part of your life to not. Was it hard, and how did you make it work?
It's hard because you go from, you know, being on national television in front of millions of people and playing in front of 100,000 people to then, you know, the next week or next month or next year, whenever your career is done, and not being a part of that. And I missed that for a very long time. And, you know, with football, it's really, really hard to fill that void. I don't know that you ever can, because you can't, you know, yeah, there's 7-on-7 leagues and stuff like that, but you can't put pads on and a helmet on to go out and play pickup football somewhere, you know.
That's right.
You just can't do that. So I think for me personally, it did take a while to kind of realize that, and then also to kind of in a way fill the void, but you're never going to fill it, is you have to find something, a career that you're going to be passionate about and that you like and you enjoy. I was fortunate enough to jump into a sales career, but I was doing something that I didn't love and I didn't fully enjoy. And then maybe 12 years ago, as I was turning 30 or my late 20s, I was able to get an opportunity to work for a sporting good company, mm-hmm. and work with coaches and athletic directors and teams on apparel and uniforms and equipment. And that really, for me, made me feel good about where I was going and what I was going to do with my career and the rest of my life. So I was back in sports. I was working with coaches, talking with coaches, and kind of wet that whistle for being involved in sports. So it's kind of what I've been doing the last 12 plus years. And I enjoy it. Like any job, it has its ups and downs, but at the end of the day, I really like what I do, and it makes me happy. So I've learned that. Took a couple years after football, but you know, for me, that was the big thing, is to find something that you're passionate about and really enjoy to do.
I had two random unrelated thoughts. One is, seeing as you're a Maryland football fan, a few months back we had Stan Gelba as our guest.
Yeah.
Stan, really good guy. And I actually covered him in high school at Cumberland Valley High School. Really good guy.
So okay, he's a great guy. He actually worked, I think, the company my dad worked for several years, construction company down in the D.C. area. Yeah. So
the other random thing I had was the last game of your redshirt freshman year, you guys are down at Virginia, and if you need a win to get bowl eligible, and they ran a fumble back. I think in the replay age, that wouldn't have been a fumble. What on your part, what is your perspective on that play? In real time, I didn't think it was a fumble, but what is your perspective on that?
Oh, I think with replay, I think my knee was down. I think it would be
overturned.
That's what I thought in real time.
That
was confirmed unofficially. Like if you go back and watch the tape, and they do slow down a replay, my knee was down. Yeah, that was a game that was supposed to be played in the beginning of September, but 9/11 pushed that out.
Okay.
It was just a weird day. I mean, we didn't play well. I didn't play well. Virginia ran a 3-4 defense and Al Golden did a great job disguising things and moving guys around, which I had not seen that year. It was my first year. So they did a great job with that. And it was, you know, just one of those games where, again, I didn't play super well. I threw a couple of interceptions, but if that fumble doesn't happen, you know, we might hold on for the win.
I was gonna say, you guys were going in and you were up 14-6 at the time,
right?
Exactly
right. So we were at the very least gonna get a field goal out of that, and then the game just flipped.
I don't know why I remember weird stuff like that, but I do.
We're happy to bring up all these fond memories.
I mean, we were playing the week before up in State College, and like, I don't know, 40-degree weather, and I remember it being almost 80 degrees that day down there. Interesting day.
Zach, you're one of my favorite Penn State quarterbacks of all time, and I'm not just saying that because you're sitting there. We really appreciate you spending some time with us, and it's fun to think back on the day and those teams.
It's funny to think it's 20 years ago, really.
That's crazy, right? It's crazy. Yeah. Well, I thoroughly appreciate the time. Like I said, as I get older, I've fonder perspective of everything, and I really appreciate the chance to come on and talk with you guys about it. So I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks so much.
Be well, Zach.
Thanks, you too.
All right. See you later.
So Mike, again, as before, when we talked to like the Jerry Johnsons of the world, it's nice to pick up the narrative at a different point in some athlete's life that we covered years and years ago. Mm-hmm. And that was certainly the case with Zach, I thought.
I think back on that 0-2 season. I was maybe overdoing it a little bit. I was so impressed with him. I thought he was playing the position almost. He was almost like innovative the way he was playing the position. And again, that point guard comparison, and really thinking about this RPO style offense.
Oh, he would have crushed it. You know, he's like a left-handed Trace McSorley, I think.
I think.
If you put Zach in that offense with, you know, the Gesickis and the other guys that they had, you know, the
McSorley
Chris Godwin's,
probably had a bigger arm.
Yeah, probably.
But Zach was, I think, maybe a little bit better decision maker, though.
Maybe
he was
so.
Really a good decision maker.
I thought so, too. So that 2002 season to which he referred, he completed 57%, threw for 2,400 yards, 17 touchdowns, 10 interceptions. They went 9-4. And as we mentioned, Larry Johnson ran for over 2,000 that year.
Yeah.
And Bryant Johnson, who's really an overlooked figure in Penn State history, really probably a top 10 receiver.
Yeah.
Really a big guy who could run. And really a good player for them. Played for the Cardinals for a few years in the NFL and had some decent years, if memory serves. So
given the fact that that was kind of a low ebb in the history of Penn State football in terms of wins and losses during that era, Mills played with a lot of really good football players.
Yeah,
I
thought so too. Yeah.
Cameron Wake, and was he with there with Tomba? Was Tomba there then? Puzlesny and Connor came in at the like his senior year.
Yeah, you're right. Yes, because
that whole group. So was, yeah,
and
those running backs and
So to your point, Dave Jones, when he wrote that story about Zach in July, he mentioned that Zach in his career had arm tendonitis, knee and ankle sprains, injuries to both shoulders, and he had a concussion, which we will recall, I think it was his senior year at Wisconsin, where he and Michael Robinson both were injured, and Chris Ganner actually had to come in the game, and it was like,
yikes.
It was kind of cover your eyes time. So.
One more thing about Zach. One of the games, I think it was his senior year, near the end of his career, and you know, the quarterback comes into the interview room after the game, and he gets mobbed, and it's TV guys are all over him. If you wait and wait, those people kind of peel away. And I remember this was when he was taking a lot of shit from the students, even at Penn State at the time. And it was me and Dave and the late Jerry Keller were the only ones that were still around him. Mm-hmm. And Dave got in there and really got him to open up about what was going on and how it was making him feel. And it was an amazing thing. And Dave did an unbelievable job as the questioner without being belligerent at all. And Zach, it was amazing how open and articulate he was about what was going on in his life at that time. I can remember that so vividly just because of how sort of touching it was.
Yeah, he always struck me as a sharp guy and a tough guy in a lot of
levels.
Oh,
yeah. The toughness was never an issue with him.
And
I mean, like, mental and emotional toughness in addition to physical toughness.
So we're happy to have him on. And obviously, his life has been very successful. He's married with two kids, lives down in his native state, Maryland. And as he mentioned, he works for a wholesale sporting goods company. So he's been doing that for a while and seems very settled in his life. So we're happy for him, for sure.
Good news.
Yeah,
good
absolutely. News. So we wanted to talk about the current Penn State team, too, and their loss last week to Ohio State when they took a lead, and before you knew it, it was gone. It took a fourth quarter lead, and it disappeared in a big hurry.
I thought that on a snap-for-snap basis, that really was a pretty even football game. And I would almost say that Penn State could have won it. It was much different than the Michigan game. Much, much different. We were kind of getting yesterday when we have our press conference with Franklin. He kind of said, you know, we're better than we were a week ago. We're better than we were 2 weeks ago. We're better than we were 3 weeks ago. There was a lot of things to like on that film, and people don't want to hear that. And they don't want to hear that. Mm-hmm. That's true. People don't want to hear that. But you know, I think that you have to be thinking about 2023 at this point, to a large extent. And whereas after the Michigan game, you could not be all that optimistic about the future going forward, I think you can be more right now. So I would say that. I hope that doesn't make people think I'm a homer, but, you know. That's honestly how I saw it. And surprisingly, as Dave and I were getting ready to go home after the game, that's how he saw it too. He thought they won the line of scrimmage. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of times when they had receivers running open. Mm-hmm. I think Ohio State's secondary might be a little vulnerable.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. Anyway.
But it was an interesting game because as we talked before, the defensive end JT Samola, is that how you pronounce it, for Ohio State, who had not really been a factor for them before that game, was a huge factor in three turnovers and a couple sacks and had a pick six at the kind of the crowning achievement for Ohio State at the end of the game. Really impressive guy.
The thing about there's three or four programs in the country. Alabama's one of them. Georgia's one of them. Ohio State's one of them. Mm-hmm. Where they have stockpiled talent to the extent that guys that you don't really know about, when you get their attention, when they get your attention and you go back and look, that kid has not had much of a college career to this point. Mm-hmm. He was the number four ranked high school player in the country and the number one ranked defensive end in the country. He's from the state of Washington. Mm. That's the kind of guy that Ohio State gets and hardly anybody else has a shot at.
Yeah.
That shows up a lot. I mean, Ohio State played most of the year. They had this kid, this wide receiver, who had 300 receiving yards in the Rose Bowl last year. They've played without him for most of the year. He's probably going to be a first-round draft pick. That stockpiling is something that almost Penn State and almost everybody else in the sport can only aspire to. They're not quite there.
Speaking of which, we saw two wide receivers have big games, one for each side. Parker Washington and Marvin Harrison Jr. both had big days, both had double-digit catches. I think we can safely assume Marvin Harrison Jr. is going to be an NFL player. What say you about Parker Washington's future?
It's hard to know about him because he's got a very unusual body for a wide receiver. And Franklin told us this when they recruited him, even before he was even there. Mm-hmm. He looks more like a running back than a wide receiver from his body type. He's got really good ball skills. Mm-hmm. I mean, he can, for a little dude, he can win those 50-50s. He can really jump, and his hands are really good. I don't know that he's a really elite route runner yet, because he's not one of these guys who seems like he's open all the time. I mean, there are times when he's kind of gets lost out there, but he did not get lost on Saturday. He was as good as any player on the field.
Yeah,
he was terrific.
Yeah, I really liked his game.
And he's a tough dude.
Yeah, that's what I was going to bring out. Yeah.
Yeah, and he can do the yak, you know, the yards after catch thing. He's very good at.
He's not real tall, right? He's probably more of a slot guy in the NFL.
He's my height.
Yeah.
5'10", you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. He's not going to be AJ Green. I mean, he's but you would think this guy can play in the NFL because he's an athlete and he's tough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me he's almost kind of like, you know, a prototypical slot receiver in the NFL.
Yeah, could be.
So they have, let's see, four games left?
Right? Four games left at Indiana this week, and then Maryland, Rutgers, Michigan State. So they will be favored in all of those games, and if they, you would think they could win all of those games, and if they go 10-2, hey, you know what I thought they were going to do at the beginning of the season. I mean, I think any reasonable person, where they seem to be at in August, and to get double figure wins, and if they get 10 wins, they're going to go to the Orange Bowl or something like that.
I'd say that's deserved. I think they're a pretty good team. You know,
I do too.
I don't know if they're like a top five team, but I think they're a pretty good team.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, this is one of their better. You know, if the ball bounces another way, or if they figure out a way to block number 44 on Saturday, maybe they can win that damn game.
Yeah, that's right. And there's still some gaps there in that part of it. But I agree.
Yeah,
I think they're a pretty good team.
So we move on. I mean, we're talking here on a Wednesday night and game four of the World Series is this evening. Last night, the Phillies won 7-0 behind five home runs, and the big narrative after the game was whether Lance McCullers, the Astros starting pitcher who gave up all five of those, was tipping his pitches. And you said you've seen some things that would indicate, yes, that was the case.
They did a very good video package on ESPN's morning show today, where they showed how you know, when the breaking ball's coming, the glove is this you know, a greater distance away from his head or whatever when he's set, you know, and the glove's at a different angle, and you know, you I think that was happening. I mean, you saw Bryce Harper hit the home run and then call Alex Baum over and whisper something to him at some length. McCullers throws breaking ball and he hits it over the moon. And the other thing, not over the moon because it really was not a tape measure shot. But
it got out in a hurry.
It did. That's right. It did get out in a hurry. And the other thing I thought was interesting about it is when Schwarber hit his home run.
Oh, dear.
Which was crushed. And it was another breaking ball. It was another non-fastball. And the Astros catcher just... You could see him just look over at the Phillies dugout, and the body language was, I was thinking, he looks like he's exasperated, and maybe they thought they were stealing signs and changed the signs, and it's still happening after we changed the signs. What the hell is going on here? That seemed to me, I mean, maybe I'm it's entirely possible I'm reading too much into it, but that sort of, and the guy's got a mask on, so you can't see his face or anything, but...
That's interesting.
I thought it was really interesting.
But Smoltz kind of picked up on it during the game. Like, he picked up on it pretty early on that he was tipping his pitches.
And Pedro MLB Network had a thing with Pedro Martinez. He said there's no doubt about it. They were tipping his pitches.
Yeah. So, I mean, a guy gives up five home runs.
In five innings.
Yeah, that's
not good.
Anyway, and it's not like he's a stiff pitcher. He's an accomplished major league pitcher.
Yeah,
so
no question.
That's really odd.
And the other thing is getting that 7-0 lead, mm-hmm. and now you know the Phillies can give an inning of work to some of the guys that, and not have to use their
top level,
you know, high leverage guys in the bullpen, which I mean that was a win-win for the Phillies, obviously, in a lot of ways.
But they just have the feel of a team that's gonna pull this off.
They really do. It feels that way, and it's an amazing thing because they're not a great baseball team,
but they are right now. They are today, which is what matters.
They are right now. That's right.
So it's why you play them, Mike, right?
That's right. That's why you show up and put on the uniform, big fella.
So, on that note.
Yes, on that note.
I think I wanted a programming note. Now, yes. Next week, we will have Jeff Perlman. He's author of a new book about Bo Jackson, which is quite good, and we will be eager to speak with him about that.
Yeah, we've had Jeff on before. Yeah. He is a sports book writing machine.
He is.
And this is his latest output, so mm-hmm. we're looking forward to it.
I mean, I'll give you this one teaser. There's an anecdote in the book about the year of the strike, and the Raiders kept their scabs around. So Matt Millen and Rod Martin are there, and they want to just, like, you know, destroy any scab running back that is coming. And so Matt Millen intends to do that to Bo Jackson, not realizing it's Bo Jackson.
Oh, really?
And Bo Jackson just runs right through him. And so somebody finally had to tell him, dude, that's Bo Jackson.
Bo Jackson, hello.
That's not a scab guy. That's not like some plumber. That's Bo Jackson. So
all that and more.
All that and more.
Next week on After the Buzzer. Okay, that's it, gang. Gordy and Mike, we'll see you next week. Peace out.
We'll see you later.